Action!
So, hey guys, I'm here with Jim Jolliffe. It's really exciting to have Jim with me today because we've had a similar career. We're at the same agency and we've had a similar kind of like relatively long career shooting commercials. He's worked with some of the best directors in London, and I must say I'm a bit jealous of his career.
Well, nice to be here to have a little chat.
Yeah.
Should we get
You're
into
entirely
it
welcome, yeah. So
where do we start?
Let's start at the beginning. So let's go back to 1973. You pop out as an ox.
Yeah.
And then you didn't do very well at school. Did you have any...
No, shit at school.
Were you dyslexic or anything?
I think I probably was, but...
Yeah, it wasn't discovered back then, was it?
It wasn't discovered back
then.
Did
you find when you got a word processor and you could suddenly organise things better than... Because my handwriting...
I got into... computers when they came out, ZX81s and
Spectrums. Yeah, same my period as well. Yeah,
I kind of got into that, but I think now you kids go to school and the teachers straight away learn whether they're quite, you know, hands-on, you know, what's the word, or whether they're better at listening or better.
They're taking information, so kinetic and, or sight,
exactly.
And
we'd never had any of that, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely a hands-on kind of.
Yeah. You've got to work it out in physical space to remember it. Yeah, I'm a bit like that. I mean, that's
talking about that earlier.
Yeah, that suits the DOP very well. So going back to, because you said you started quite young, do you have a memory of being moved by cinema at an early age?
I was always into, I mean, I sort of grew up in quite a creative household. My dad actually worked in advertising for a bit as a copywriter, but then became a cartoonist. And my sisters were very good musicians, even though not as a job, just quite a musical family. Except for my mum, she was very different. She's a criminal lawyer, so...
Oh, wow.
Kind of the balance between my dad and my mum being a cartoonist and criminal lawyer is quite sort of yin and yang, but working well together.
Well, I was going to say it works really well for cinematography as well, doesn't it? Because you have the analytical mind and you have the creative mind, which I think you need both in equal measure.
Yeah,
I think the most successful have to have both, really, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, because it relies on so much kind of knowledge of equipment that unless you have that down,
you do need a bit of technical understanding, which I think you learn also. I mean, I worked up through the ranks. So I started when I was about 17 working as a runner, and then knew what I wanted to, actually when I was really young. I wanted to saw Star Wars, and I thought that's what I want to do, special effects. I want to do special effects in films. It's amazing, spaceships, explosions.
Yeah,
you know, so that's kind of what I wanted to do as a 10-year-old, I guess.
Yeah,
and then my sister went out with a guy who worked at Lift and Shoot, which is a film transport company.
And
at the time, they had a Chevy van which looked like the 18 van. It was a black van with a red stripe down it. And I thought, that is the coolest job. You know, he drives this 18 van around.
How old were you? When this...
13 or something, I guess. I'm not even that. And then he went off and became a loader and he worked on like Empire of the Sun and he brought me back a clapperboard of Empire of the Sun. I thought, and camera department then was like the coolest job. You could, like, really, I was like, that's
fine. It's the eye of the storm.
I wanted to do camera department.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I wanted to do.
And that gives you quite an advantage in the career to know it that early.
Yeah, which is really unusual for people generally to know whatever career they want to do, to know
at an early age
what they want to do. And I was always into photography as a teenager as well and stuff. So I kind of knew photography. I taught myself photography
in
the teens kind of thing. So
you can see that in your work as well because, you know, I think you're very, very good at capturing moments, but you also have a real eye for light, well, obviously. But, you know, it's nice actually to see on your website that there's a section dedicated to photography. Because I think if I was a director, I'd like to know a little bit more about the DOP rather than what's the latest stuff they shot.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to know how artistic they are. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's quite
important.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why Instagram used to be quite good, but now it's shit.
So. Yeah, yeah. It's a point. Do you want to talk a little bit about your Cinematographers UK?
Yeah, so I kind of died a death, really. I set up because I just thought there were other Instagram pages like it, so I thought we should do a Instagram page where essentially any cinematographer's UK representation, basically, was an idea, could take over this Instagram account for a week or 2 weeks, whatever it was, and post whatever they want.
Yeah.
You know? creative, so
yeah,
references.
So it's a gallery that people can curate.
Yeah, and they can either post their own work or stills they've taken or something that inspired them or whatever they want, but it's their little, it's their thing for a week.
For that week, yeah.
And it worked really well. You know, we had a good queue of people who wanted to go on it, and we kind of worked out how to keep it going easily and so people could take over. So the admin side isn't too much of a pain. Went for a couple of years, it was doing well, and then it got blocked and something happened, and it basically, Instagram somehow managed to just shut it down. Somehow, and I think the email address got hacked, and so the email address got changed, so I never got any warning of it, and it got shut down, and there was like 20,000 images on there, and it's just all gone. So I messaged Instagram, said, look, it's not been hacked, blah, 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 and they were like, too late, it's gone. So
wow, that's a warning to everyone there, isn't
really,
it?
Really, yeah, really.
People's
like,
careers are
such
their
a
whole
good library of just lovely images and stuff of anyone, you know, all the DOPs in the UK. And then somebody tried relaunching it, and it kind of went for a bit. I don't know what happened to it, really. But I just thought, because the admin was a bit of a pain, so I just couldn't
possibly see. So you had someone helping you with that?
No, I was just doing it. It was just every week just sending an email to someone just to the instructions that they had to do.
Yeah,
it wasn't that hard, but it was just...
Yeah, it's another thing to think about on top of all the work you're getting there. Yeah.
It was good while it lasted, and it's a shame it kind of ended, really, I thought.
So what I like the most about Instagram is the fact that you have this archive, historic archive. Of, it's like, you know, it's nice to see historically how things develop with someone's work.
Yeah.
And to not, because actually that made me think that I wanted to take everything off Instagram and back it up just in case that happened to us.
Yeah.
So I learned a lesson from that. That's a very valuable lesson. But imagine a young DOP and their whole work, their whole kind of like, point of sale kind of thing is Instagram, and they lose their account. I mean that would be pretty traumatizing.
Happen, you know, it happens to quite a few artists, photographers as well. You post an image that's censored or something.
They got a lot of power, haven't they? This platform,
but it's just a bit annoying now, because they're obviously pushing away from stills into more
video,
content and video, and you know, just drivel on there now.
Yeah,
TikTok is the way
it's becoming like TikTok.
Yeah, and it's just a bit of a shame.
Why we're expanding to podcasts, because you know it's like the thing that I find interesting about this new generation is that they want everything immediate and have this really low attention span, yet they're still willing to listen to a 2.5 hour podcast. That's a bit of this culturally. It's you know it, you know that new this sort of Z gens. They have both interests. Yeah. So, and we've proven with podcasts that people actually don't have a short attention span. They just want to be. I think it's
they
probably
just want the right information, you know. Yeah. It's just like it's kind of like I just chatted about this earlier with someone actually, and you've got YouTube and then you've got Vimeo, which is more, you know, proper films, and someone should do a similar thing. So now you've got Instagram, which is all the shit, and then you have another platform, or even do a paid Instagram, a paid tier where you just get, you know, content good but you know, something where it's more of a premium artists, photographers, filmmakers, and everything that post there.
Yeah, there's definitely a need for that. Yeah. You're quite right.
Some girls standing, you know.
Yeah. One of the things about Set Notes is the goal is to try and inspire people to go out there and create, right? Mm. That's the kind of, you know, fundamentally, that's what it's all about, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's about
inspiring.
So you went to this media school?
Yeah, for a couple of years, which was fine. I mean, I didn't really, it was just more just...
Did you get hands on any cameras or anything?
Yeah, we shot product. Stuff. I mean, to be honest, it was most of the stuff that everyone shot was pretty shit. but because I was into it already, and I sort of made a couple of good friends there who are really into it as well. So actually, we made some quite fun short films. We shot on Super 8 and...
Oh, great, that's my first film was Super 8.
Yeah,
got me into film school.
And then we entered into some little film festivals and won a few things, which was quite sweet. Got arrested making it.
Oh, well, nice. Yeah. Notch on the TV.
Yeah, exactly. It was good learning, but being out on set, it was obviously the best.
So you said you started as a runner. Was it a commercial production company?
Started as a runner, freelance, actually. It's when Wizzo used to do a thing called Just Runners, and she's...
Right.
So I spoke to her, and then if a production company is looking for a runner, they'd ask, have you got any runners? And so like a dive service kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just for runners.
Yeah. And you came out of film, the media course,
that.
And went
but
straight
also,
onto that.
Yeah, did a bit of that. I mean, my sister was a producer, so it was nepotistic thing there where she got jobs as well. And then I say 17 or 18 and managed to get on the Commitments of Alan Parker movie.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
As camera trainee, so that was good.
And did you know when you were on long form, did you kind of mark out and say, actually, I want to do short form even
though? No, not really. I mean, I'm not a pushy person at all. I'm not I love what I do, but I'm not overly ambitious. I've just always thought it's like a river. You just, it takes you where it takes you, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, so I worked as a camera trainer and runner and then a loader for about 5 or 6 years and a focus pool about 5 or 6 years and an operator. So I kind of worked up through the ranks in a very slow process, which was brilliant for me.
Because you got to work with some really good people and learn from them.
Yeah, people, and I got good experience and understanding of other DOPs and film set generally and other directors and stuff. So it was a fantastic learning experience. But
my career, I didn't stay in camera for long enough, actually. And one of my regrets is that I didn't get to spy on enough of a DOP, so I didn't really know how to behave as a DOP on a film set. So I found that I had a technical appetite, but when it came to actually doing the role of a DOP, it's not just that, it's so much more. And that's
weird, isn't it? It's like directors as well. When you work with directors and you see directors that work so differently, and you just think, these guys never get to see how other directors work. Or DOPs, when you're a DOP, you have no idea.
Yeah.
How other people.
Yeah, it's like ships passing in the night, and it's it's so valuable to see how everyone has a different approach and see and learn some little tricks. Every time I'm on a set, I learn a little trick from another DOP. So I was quite lucky because I had a director. I noticed that you work a lot with Siri.
Yeah.
So I had one girl, female director, that Zara Dunlop, who got me started.
Yeah, she's great, Zara.
Yeah, and she let me come on before she could actually use me, because I was, I was very inexperienced. She allowed me to come on to some of the sets of some of the more established DOPs and watch them work.
Good. Yeah.
So that was quite a good start for me.
Where's she now? She was at Rattling.
She's gone to
Hunky Dory, no.
Corner Shop. It's
Corner Shop, yeah, Corner
it
Shop.
It is Corner Shop, yeah.
I think it's Corner Shop,
I think that's for the American market, probably.
Yeah.
Actually, but when I look at Siri's work, I look at Zara's, they kind of got a similar sort of sophistication to them.
Yeah.
What's Siri like to work with?
I love working with her. She's got a very fresh mind. She's always thinking. She's always sort of, obviously always thinking. She's always
sort of recalibrating.
Exactly. So you could set up something and then she'd go, oh no, actually this is better. She's she makes decisions, and which might mean changing everything.
Yeah.
But and
she's happy to flow.
But actually, it's worth it. You know, actually, if you want to do the best job, then you can just do this.
Like,
we could be lazy and do this, but let's do the best we can and do it. And she's good, and she always pushes me, which I love as well.
Yeah,
she's great.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because to be on set and to, you know, because we do we sort of, as a DOP, you repeat certain techniques that you know have worked in the past.
Yeah.
But to keep fresh eyes on it and to be challenged, I think.
It's really,
you know, oftentimes directors push me as well and get me to rethink it. And I come away thinking, that was kind of interesting, because I was happy to settle for that. And actually,
I wonder if there's some DOPs out there who kind of fight that, who don't like it being pushed.
I'm sure there are. Yeah.
I love it.
I mean, it's down to personality as well. Yeah. The whole Pisces thing of sort of fitting in and flow and going with flow is probably... that's one of the lessons I had to learn, actually, because I was a bit feisty on set for many years, and I had to learn that, you know, to support the director. And the other mistake I made was, when I did learn to support the director, I did it in so much so that I used to upset the producer, because I used to fight their battles for them, which wasn't for me to fight.
It's tricky, isn't it?
So that was another mistake that I had to learn. It took me a while to learn that one as well. Right, so let's talk a little bit about your work, shall we? So, I mean, I think coming up in the camera department really helped you, because I would imagine you got on set with some really good directors, and they knew of you when you were in the camera department, rather than having to try and win work off them as a DOP without them having you.
Yeah, I guess.
So could you tell me a little bit about the transition from, you were focused, your operator, you said?
Yeah, well, I kind of was pretty much everything. So transition from loader to focus was very much DOP-led, DOPs I work with.
They started saying you're ready for focusing
I've got a drama. I used to do quite a few dramas and stuff. And so I did, then I used to do sort of longer form stuff. And they'd say, look, you should be focusing now. And same, operating was actually, as I was focusing, if there's second camera, I started doing operating a lot with a second camera.
Yeah, and how did you feel about operating? Because that's another way of spying on a DOP, isn't it?
I love operating. Yeah, great. Because you just, you know, it's I love composition side of it as well. When you're operating, you can just focus on the composition and obviously the light, but you know, it's mainly just finding a
beautiful shot. I think with your work is so special is that you managed to get this, I call it like a sort of cinematic documentary or sort of magic realism. There's one job where you're shooting on homeless people on the streets of London.
Oh yeah.
And that could have quite easily been really not visually good. Yeah. And you managed to find a way without, I would imagine, with very minimum.
Nothing.
Yeah.
That was actually, to the credit, that was a director, was a young guy at Rattling Stick who was, used to write the treatments, well, I don't know if he still does, write the treatments of Rattling Stick, like with Josh Carpenter. And he just, it was his idea, he came up with it, which is a brilliant idea, and it was really lovely, you know. And so, but again, it was just three or four of us in the street with a C300.
And you doing, it seemed to me you were doing drive-by shots in the vehicle.
Yeah, a couple of drive-by shots. Yeah. And I just think I had one battery operated, like a sun gun type thing, just to give it a
And were you on an easy rig or handheld? Do you hold the camera?
No, that was just handheld.
Yeah.
Generally, I just handhold it. I can keep it pretty steady handheld, even if walking around. Easy rigs, I tend to find... I find them annoying because you're walking with them, you get off the
weird bounce. Yeah.
Unless you have that silly arm thing.
The serene,
And then also because it's such a pain taking it on and off, you end up wearing it more.
Yeah.
So in between takes, you end up going,
And it spins around and hits people in the head.
Yeah. You end up having it, wearing it more, so it ends up being just as heavy rather than having if you want to.
Do you have any system of support with that? Do you do loose bars or
in an ideal world, have a camera built as light as possible.
Yeah.
But that's, nowadays, you've got cine tapes and all the shit that's on there is hard. You think, God, cameras are getting smaller, but
all the stuff, it's like a tree of stuff.
And also, cameras used to be like film camera was well balanced. You'd have the mag behind you, so it's
like an arsenal.
Balanced, whereas.
Yeah. So it's like a cat sleeping on your shoulder.
Yeah.
An arsenal.
Whereas now they're a bit more awkward, but I just have moose bars.
Because one of my favourite handheld, there's two guys that I think do excellent handheld in the film world. One of them is Christopher Doyle, who works a lot for Wong Kar-wai. And the other one is Bobbitt.
Sean Bobbitt. Yeah, he's great as well.
I mean, I saw the latest Steve McQueen, I can't remember what it's called now, but it's a series. That was pretty special for me because my sisters were really into Caribbean culture, so I grew up in that environment.
Yeah.
And his handheld when they were dancing just blew me away. I
really
just thought,
good,
man, this guy's really getting into the spirit of everything.
Yeah, small acts.
Small acts, that's it, yeah. So do you strip, because Christopher Doyle, what he does is he gets a pillow, straps it around his, and uses his shoulders
I've done that sometimes.
Elbows
with a cine saddle around my head and just had it here and you rest your arms in the cine saddle.
You've got the height advantage as well. So
well, sometimes, but generally you've got the camera here, so I end up spending most of my time with my legs bent or spread wide apart to get lower because being tall is a bit annoying sometimes.
The problem for me is when I get a taller model than me.
Yeah. Well.
And I've got to pack it up to the camera.
Oh, because it's tricky. I mean, because you end up being comfortable. It's easy to fall into being comfortable just having a shoulder where there's a certain lower height that's comfortable, but any kind of heights in between that aren't so comfortable, you end up you've got to really force yourself to go
what's your view on gimbal
for the right thing? It's brilliant.
Because I think there's one piece of work I saw that looked to me like it was gimbal shot in Africa, Land Rover.
No, that was just in the back of a pickup handheld.
Gimbal
on that.
And then you had the Siri job you did with over energy.
Was that
Steadicam?
That was handheld, I think. There might have been some Steadicam. No, I think most of it was
really
handheld.
Did they post stabilize it? Because it looks really smooth. Is there a boy coming out from outside to inside and taking his shirt off and having?
And that's not. No, that was British Heart Foundation.
Oh, sorry.
That was Steadicam.
Yeah.
was Rick Willard on Steadicam.
Oh right, yeah, I've worked with Rick. Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah, he's really great. Yeah. That was a good. I thought that was a really good Steadicam sequence.
It was really hard. I mean, that kid, how old was he? 12 or 13 or something. Yeah. He had.
Do the whole thing,
60 seconds of dialogue essentially in one take.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
It's non-stop dialogue. It's tricky.
How many takes did you do with that?
Quite a few.
Yeah.
Because it was a classic thing. Whoever wrote the idea never thought of reading it. So even if you just read it, it came to like 70 seconds essentially. So they're trying to make the boy read it really quickly to try and squeeze it into the length, but actually you just couldn't. So they had to cut some lines, make
Yeah.
no one sit there and read this before?
Right. This is one of my biggest gripes with commercials, is that they write 60-second ideas for a 30-second slot all the time.
Yeah.
And then they force you to shoot 60 seconds, knowing that half of it's going to end up on the floor and the quality goes down when they just wrote it properly and timed it out and did animatic. I love an animatic.
Animatics are good, because then
you can work out exactly how long the shots are. And you can say to the director, is this going to be a second, 2 seconds? What is it? Yeah. What are we looking at here? Yeah. And I like all of that structure, personally.
It is frustrating, right? When you see these guys have been working on this ad for 3 months.
Yeah, and they can't get a fundamental
thing. And then you shoot half it and they go, actually, no, we want to change this idea thing.
Yeah.
Working on it for three months.
What amazes me is that advertising agencies are now having their own little production wing.
Yeah.
And what amazes me is that I shouldn't really say this, but they've been on set for like 20 years and you'd think they'd pick up a thing or two about production.
Yeah.
And they really don't seem to, I don't see the evidence of them that actually having.
I mean, it's tricky. I've done a few jobs direct with agency and some of them are lovely, but some of them are shit. Generally, it's the latter.
Yeah.
Just because they don't have the pool of directors, they don't have. It's just the always just tend to be the lower. But I've done some really lovely stuff. I did some nice nationwide ones recently with an agency producer who used to be at VCCP, who was essentially directing them because they didn't have a director. So she kind of did it herself, and they're really sort of natural, very humanistic, lovely people talking about the mortgages and stuff like that.
But see, that would be your, I think the evidence on your reel is that there's quite a lot of that work, which I think you kind of cornered that, you know, like if I was a director and I wanted that, you're very good at getting that emotion across, and you've got a very light touch, you know, it's like, so you shoot, it almost looks like a documentary, but it's beautiful and magical, and it's got all these other elements that I think very hard. I mean, like, for example, your first, I can't even read it, TED.
Oh, Entelechy thing. Yeah, that was...
What a name for a company, eh?
Yeah, I know, Entelechy Arts.
Yeah.
Have I announced it? Maybe I've got that one.
Yeah.
That was nice. Again, that was just a director, Sonia Phillips, who's lovely. It's just like five of us just going around.
Yeah.
Again, because very old people who had lost partners. That one you were talking about, a guy had lost his wife. And it was a very emotional story, actually. But anyway, the situation like that is just keeping it minimum crew.
Yeah.
Minimum lighting as well. And actually, lighting not on the floor, so everything lit from outside where possible. Yeah. So it's just not equipment.
What light did you have out there?
I can't remember. I think I just had like a, because we had to run off local power, I think I just had a M40 with a 2.5 bulb in just outside.
Was it direct or did you?
I can't remember. I think it was a textured window. So I think I just played around. Quite often, you know, you pan it off a little bit.
To get the edge. I love the edge of light.
So it might have been that. And did I have anything? I can't remember, to be honest. But I kept it really, really simple.
Do you work with the same gaffer on most of your UK work, or do you have a mixture?
It's a good question, actually. I do and I don't. I seem to go, not by choice, I seem to go through stages. Because availability of them, because they're all bloody never available, trying to find a gaffer. So there's about three or four who I like working with and try and get them.
So I got a different track on that. What I've done, because I've got into this Lightstream Keen Airflow system.
Yeah.
And the Lightstream's the little reflectors.
Oh, because I use the CRLS a lot.
Oh, yeah. I love that. There's one job actually on your, at the end, where it's a woman in bed. She looks like it's a short film. I was wondering about the CRLS.
No, well before that. That was...
Because it had a really nice quality of light in the room.
It was a friend of mine, girlfriend at the time, wanted to do a short film. She ended up getting into some really top Swedish film school from it.
I'm not surprised.
And that we had, again, no budget. And I quite like that, you know, challenge of just trying to do something with fuck all money and fuck all equipment.
Do you have relationships at the facility houses?
Yeah, some of them. You know, that one, I think, they managed to get off, I think it was like a theatre lighting. But, so basically, I got a Parcan, a set of dados, and one by one, light panel when they were just those bicolour one by one things.
Yeah, so you can do a lot with that.
And that shot of her in bed was actually the Parcan pinged into on the wall in there was a like a dressing mirror. So I just pinged into the mirror and reflected.
I could see there was a texture in there. It's quite nice. Yeah, and it looked like reflected light rather than direct.
Yeah.
Because for me, I like to try and get away from direct light when I can because I think it looks more found, more natural than film. trying to get away from the artifice of the film, like for me, yeah, it's like, you exactly, know,
it does
going to the edge.
Look, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, blasting an M18 or you know, like a big Arri light through a window, for me, I spot that. Yeah. I just don't think it's got any delicacy for me.
I know what you mean.
So,
but they're great, those. Yeah, CRLS or yeah. I've not used the Dado ones, but they're quite similar, aren't they?
Well, I mean,
is that what that is?
Yeah. So Dado, what Dado's done is he's taken, because they had a, it's an interesting story. Christian Berger was the guy who developed the CRLS system.
You're right.
He won an Oscar for The White Ribbon. He works with a lot of Michael Haneke. He's a Dutch director. And he won, I mean, if you see The White Ribbon, it's beautifully executed.
Yeah.
But he also did a film in America, the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
That was actually with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And they shut the whole island down. And what amazed me, because the lights he uses is these people, what they call, in the Dado versions of PB70, it's a 1.2K parabolic beam light.
Yeah.
And he lights through windows with 1.2K of light in the Mediterranean.
Wow.
Because it's so efficient this way. Yeah. So basically,
they're very spotty.
Yeah. It's like a parallel beam light.
Yeah.
So there's a few advantages to that. One of them is that you need less light. The other advantage is you get parallel shadows, so it looks more like the sun. So you can actually put your reflectors quite close in, and you get this feeling that something's far away.
You've only got a beam this wide, have you?
Well, the PB70 is 70 centimetres, so it's about the size of this table.
Oh, okay.
So that's the big boy, and that's the thing that Christian Berger did. But there was a theatrical company that, Pani was the name of it, and they stopped making it. So then Dado took over and started making his own, and then they fell out. They had a falling out. So Dado just went, well, I'm going to carry on and just do Lightstream. And the advantage of Lightstream over CRLS is that Lightstream is a full system. So all of his small lights that are brilliant optics, as you well know, have these little additional lenses that go on the front that basically allows the lens to have up to five times more light in the spot.
I've heard of this with the normal Dados. I've heard like this. I guess they kind of work like, you know, for DSLRs, you get the... that turns Super 35 to full frame,
they're not
the ones that, what are they called, you know, 0.7 time.
Oh yes, the ones that kind of well, basically the theory behind the lighting, the data ones is that when you go into the flood portion of the light, and when you flood the light, the bulbs actually come to the front of the optics, so you get way more light. Because when you're in a spot position, you're at the back, and then you have a lot of light lost in the barrel of the light.
Right.
So what he's done is he brought it to the front to get that five times more light, and then he uses another lens to focus that light.
Fine.
So it's just making the light more efficient, basically.
So you can still flood and spot it though,
you only really use them with the reflectors. Fine. So the idea of the reflectors, if you want to get different qualities of light, you change your reflector out.
Fine.
So you put these little lights onto the reflectors, and then you go, what's number one look like? Direct sunlight. Number two, hazy sunlight. Number three, got a really beautiful kind of...
Same as the CRLS.
Yeah.
I think.
But what I love about them is the philosophy of lighting with them, because you basically, rather than doing what I call subtractive light, where you blast a whole light through a window and then you put flags and nets to try and get the shape you want, you do an additive. So it's like painting. It's like you go, oh, I want a little highlight there and a little highlight there.
That's kind of how I like to light, is see what you've got, you know,
I can see that in your work.
I think it's just keeps it simple as well.
Certainly with the
document, every time you do end up just trying to overpower what's there, and you just think, oh, now you're, saying that, it completely depends on the job
and you've done everything, basically. You've done car commercials, you've done food, you've kind of done it all.
Yeah.
But what I think I can see that you found your kind of your stride in this sort of documentary, magic realism documentary or whatever we want to call it. You clearly experience, and you can do a car, you can do this, you can do that, and you know, but when I see that work on your reel, it feels to me a little bit more commercial looking. And when where I see your other work, your more documentary work, I feel it's got a slightly different, a unique voice,
which is your voice. Yeah, it's interesting, because I've got quite a lot of charity jobs, like that Entelechy one. I did a nice, God knows what it was, help the aged type thing, Red Cross recently and stuff. And because you're not selling a product, so you haven't got that thing of, someone tell you, can you make it a little bit brighter, you light it, and then they just turn it right up in the grade, and you weren't able to make the grade, and you send them loads of reference photographs of how it should look, and then you get the final thing, you think, what?
Yeah.
So just like crazy.
Yeah, that happens to me quite a lot.
So frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, and now they don't, the good old days when we were shooting on film, they'd leave the DOP and the director to kind of find a look.
Yeah.
And nowadays, because it's like, you know, so I use the phrase, a racehorse designed by a committee is a camel.
Yeah.
Because everyone's hovering around a monitor.
Yeah.
And everyone's got an opinion. And it's almost like the junior people are more dangerous because they have to have an opinion just to keep
their
jobs.
I try and always go to grades where I can, definitely if it's a job I really care about.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Because I see that's between part of myself and I'll be sat up at the front with the colourist, and you can, if back row start, oh, can you do that? You tend to press a few bullshit buttons. And,
yeah, you know, yeah, you do a tiny,
flip,
tiny
flip
little
between two different things. Yeah, on, off, on, off, and it's like,
That's a really good way of working it.
Or
yeah.
just, you know, or doing it and then just like bringing it back. Or doing, because it's just.
To try and hold on to the integrity.
I think in that situation, I think people quite often just like to have an opinion. It's quite an exciting time for certain people to be in the grade.
Yeah.
And so they want to have an opinion as well, just for the sake of
What I find the worst scenario in the grade is when they try and put a wash and go in a different direction to everything that was discussed previously. So you've lit
that's
it.
That's really annoying.
Yeah, you've lit it a certain way and then they go off in another direction because they're so excited by the technology. Yeah. And that's just that's when I sort of pipe up and say, actually, we did it for this. This is keep the colour separate. My advice, you know, when I'm talking to graders, it's always like, try and just do what we did in the lighting and keep the colour separate, keep it all there and just like enhance it rather than go off
completely
on
completely different, And if you do go off, then do you go off how I wanted to go off?
Yeah. You know? Do you use LUTs at all when you're on set?
Generally not. I mean, I do sometimes, but I just find safer not to. I just...
I'm direct 709. I always say to the directors, this is a shitty LUT, and if it looks good here, then you're in a good place.
And then, with a dip on set, I might go over and, because I always get the dip to send me his photo notes. Album kind of thing. So he does a lot of iPhoto shared album type thing. So I'll go over to him and he'll send me the photo and I go, oh, can you just adjust that? Can you do this? Can you do that?
Yeah.
And he'll then resend it. And then once I've got the photographs of kind of closer to how I want them, I then say to him, can you add the director?
That's a nice process.
That's quite good. And that's a good relationship with having...
Do you work with similar... Do you have a kind of collection of DRTs that you work
with? I mean, I have one DIT I love working with, but it seems like everyone else loves working with them, so it's always busy. And actually quite hard to find a good DIT. So I've got two or three I like working with, and it's like... Dips, grips, and gaffers. Jesus.
And a lot of dips don't see their job as they stand by a computer and just data monkey kind of thing, and that's not what their job is,
exactly,
really.
I
feel you on
that. Where some dips love that side of it, you know, they love being involved in, you know, with the look of it and everything.
It's
very rewarding for them as well, you know.
Yeah.
Be involved in
It's kind of like an onset first kind of grade, really, isn't
exactly,
it? So they get to see what you can do with it. So let's get into, we touched on lighting a little bit. We touched on Dado. I use Kinoflow quite a lot.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is I'm quite wary of the new LED technology. Yeah. You know, like a lot of DOPs like to stick to tungsten or HMI because the colour of LED can be all over the place.
Yeah.
Even sky panels have a problem, I think, because the age of the LED dies on them age, and to find two that look the same. And the thing I love about the Kinoflow system is it's an ecosystem that's designed to all be perfectly matched.
So when you say the Kinoflow, you mean LED Kinos?
LED Kino, They have this colour matched kind of technology where they even get the chip of the camera dialed into the light, so everything white on different cameras is a different white, right? So they even goes that far, because because Frida, the guy who developed it, you've seen the film Barfly with Mickey Rourke?
God, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, 1980s film. Yeah, so he lit Faye. Yeah. I think it's Faye Dunaway. He lit her with fluorescent tubes, and she was like, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah.
You know, she was very vain, obviously, big movie star.
Yeah.
And he managed to get a sneaker tube in there, and she ended up really liking it.
Yeah.
And that's when fluorescence first came along, and then he got really into the colour science thing, because fluorescence are spiky like LEDs are, so he had to kind of smooth all the colours out, and then that technology. And he held back on the LED because, and then the market share went to, you know, companies like Sky, you know, Arri Sky Panel, and you know, like. What's the tubes called? Everyone uses Astera and all of that.
Yeah.
But now he's starting to introduce the new lights. But they have one ecosystem, and I love that because one of the things that I really like about your work, I think of it as like a flow of light in a room.
Yeah.
So your work doesn't look lit because I think you stay true to that flow of light. So if light's coming into a room and it's bouncing off a yellow wall, then somehow you manage to make it look natural, either by having a yellow bounce or whatever. It just feels like the flow of light is true to the room.
But then sometimes I look at my stuff. I'm, as I'm sure every DOP is, quite self-critical, and I look at stuff and think, God, I should do more kind of lit, because I see other people's work. I think, God, that is really lit but beautiful.
Yeah.
And, I should try doing more. And I do the odd job that's quite kind of lit, but generally, it is very natural, and try and use what's there and keep the same feeling but more beautiful, obviously.
It's like we said, that cinematic documentary.
Yeah.
But you do, I think, see, I like your work because I go a bit too far with that. I'm trying to get shafts of light and everything because of my reflector system, and you know, and I like to, I'm a bit frightened of colour. And I must say, when I started my career, there's a lot of French DOPs that really embrace colour. And I was always a bit like held back on that. And now, because of the Kino Flow system, I want to start trying to get more colours.
Yeah, I was the same. So when it's, now things are more LED, you can embrace colour more because
it's so quick.
It's not a matter of just picking the white gel and actually hold up a gel and you think, that's perfect. You put it in front of a light and it's completely different. You know, the quality of what it gives you is very different to how you, so trying to, unless you spend weeks testing loads of gels, and even then it's near enough impossible. But having LED where you can look at the camera and just be given a control yourself and just dial it in and just go, that's perfect, and you know, and just get it right.
That's the future, isn't it?
I mean, that's, I'm not that specific about lights in the sense of you're about the exact colour balance of each light and everything. It doesn't really bother me so much, but I do love the LED system and being able to just have it on an iPad and just be able to, you know, not if a gaffer can just give me an iPad or a gaffer's box control, you know, saying, and I can just do it, look for the camera and just tweak every light myself. It's so quick.
Yeah.
So
and like, that is the future.
You know, rather than telling someone, can you move that, you know, turn that, bring that backlight down or whatever, and then we'll just have, it's just a lot quicker. When you've got art department on set and everyone floating around, just be able to just do it yourself rather than speaking to a gaffer to tell the spot. You know,
so going back to gaffers, I worked with some really good ones over the years. Chris Dowling was a really, I worked with him a lot, and I really loved working with him. And then what happened was Chris and me, is that Chris went on to start working with the younger DOPs and start supporting, because they really need an experienced gaffer. Mm. And he adds a lot of value, you know, and all that generation add a huge amount of value to these younger DOPs.
A good gaffer is massively...
Yeah, particularly when you're young, because you don't know how to light. Yeah. I would argue it takes about 10 years to get good at lighting, I'd say.
It's not like 10 years to get good. I think it's a constant.
A good constant, but for me,
but then you look at things you did 10 years ago, and you think, oh, I couldn't do that now because where you think is differently. So sometimes you look back at things and you think, well, that's brilliant, but would I do that? I mean, to be honest, every job I do, I think I look back at even the evening of or the day after, I think I probably would have done differently. Or you know, it's like that's what.
Do you have regret then when you look at?
Not regret. No, I just. I can never be an editor because it's too many choices, you know. Whereas it's like when I take a photo of my camera and I take a photo of something, and I take 10, you know, nowadays you take 10 photos and I look at you and think, okay, and you need to keep one, and I just can't pick. I'm just so indecisive. And it's like that, is that if I light something like that evening, I go, oh, I wish I could have done that differently, I could have done that differently. But yeah, I could have done, and on a different day I probably would have done, but there's no right or wrong way of doing
it. Going back to your Pisces and your flow, being in flow again. Yeah, that's what I can see. Yeah.
See that.
Well, it adds to your work, because it's a sort of effort. Like I said, it's an effortlessness. So what you said at the beginning of this conversation, that I'm not that ambitious. Yeah. Which, you know, some people see that as a negative, but I see it as a kind of positive. Then you're present on set and you're sort of more in flow with what's going on and you're more sensitive to the director's needs because you're not kind of trying to get a readable piece of yourself. Yeah. And I think that's
probably Instagramming on set the whole time.
And I think that's why you work with such good directors, because I think they feel safe with you.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Maybe.
You know, I mean, you know, it's impossible to say without speaking to them, but certainly looking at work and the companies you work for and the directors you work for.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, I can learn from that myself.
Well, actually, we're talking about that Interlecky job. The director who did that was from Channel 4 as well.
Right. It's good training, man. Because they get to learn a bit of editing, they get to learn a bit of production. Yeah. They kind of, they're one sort of, they have an overview of the whole process, which is really helpful.
You know, I worked with a director a couple of weeks ago, Neil Gorin. She was from Channel 4.
Yeah.
And I got a pencil cut. And it's the same with Red Bee, which used to be called BBC Creative Services. A good group of directors came out of there as well.
Yeah, I worked with Steve Cope, who was ex-Red Bee.
Exactly. Yeah. Steve Cope and Rick Cantor and
Simon, Rick Cantor, you worked with Rick
Neil.
Yeah.
yeah. Uh,
I've worked with Rick. Sorry.
Yeah, I've worked with him.
I've worked with him once. Is he Rogue now?
I don't think he's at Rogue. I used to work assist for a DOP, Mike George, and he used to work a lot with them. I did TV series as a camera assistant.
Yeah.
Man Stroke.
Oh, is it Outsider? I'm trying to. Yeah,
it might be Outsider.
Yeah.
And Simon Neal, I've got pencil with. He's ex Red B. It was good learning for. I don't know if it still is that, or whether that was just an era of.
Yeah, well, they had Channel 4. I mean, I worked a lot of Film 4 as well, and I had this guy, Brett Foraker.
Yeah, Brett Foraker.
Who did the whole Channel 4 logo things, which is just genius.
Yeah.
And he was a really creative man.
Yeah.
He used to make me laugh, though, because he always wore sunglasses in the grade.
Yeah.
And I was sitting outside in Soho with Simon one day, and the sun was just still out. And I was jokingly saying to Simon, this is the only time that I'm going to see Brett wearing his sunglasses appropriately.
Yeah.
And just as he turned the corner, the sun went. I was like, well, not even that. So, yeah. But yeah, he went to America.
Yeah, he lives in LA now.
So let's talk a little bit more about my favourite, Chris Palmer, again.
Yeah, yeah.
So because he was gorgeous with Frank Budgen. And Frank Budgen died, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, if people don't know, Frank Budgen sort of changed. Well, he was one of the most relevant sort of directors in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, massively. I think. And actually, his body, I mean, soon after he died, why not that scene? A couple of years after he died, Gorgeous organised a sort of a screening of a sort of all his work at cinema.
Yeah.
And you forget the body of incredible work he'd done, you know.
Yeah. Just
every job was just amazing. You
know? Yeah.
Not only just direction, but also the story, which I guess. Yeah. Probably was him a lot as well.
Because
he does.
I think
he's ex, as Chris, they're both ex-agency.
That's right. So one of the directors I work with a lot, Steve Hudson, was a copywriter for, art director for Frank Budgen.
Right.
And he said that what he'd do is go through scripts and go, that's an award winner, and just pluck them out, like instantly knew which one was going to win an award. And he was always right, apparently.
Yeah.
And he, I mean, I asked a lot of questions. I never got to work with him, but I asked a lot of questions about his character because he had quite an interesting character from what I hear.
I worked with him quite a bit as an assistant and operator as well.
Have you got any good Frank Budgen stories?
God, not really. I'm trying to think.
What's he like as a character on set? How would you describe him? Because one thing I heard was he had a kind of natural curiosity, like a childlike curiosity.
Definitely was a sort of childlikeness about him. That's a complimentary thing. I mean, that not, you know. He didn't suffer fools. He's just a lovely guy. He's just, it's hard to.
So it must have been quite a blow for Chris when.
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. Because that.
I mean, it was on the cards for a while, which that makes it any easier. But,
So, where's Chris now then? Has he gone to America?
No, Chris is, from my understanding, I haven't seen him for about a year or so. He's still UK. They've moved offices to, they've got their offices on a boat
what,
now.
What, Gorgeous?
Yeah.
Do you know where they are?
They're in one of the docks towards kind of the city.
Right.
They bought this big, beautiful
barge, like Dutch barge.
Barge, but no, it's like a sailing boat, but it's used in the Dunkirk, you know, when all the boats went over to. So it's a boat they use in the film Dunkirk.
Yeah.
One of the main boats now to go and.
And this is so typical, all the soldiers gorgeous,
back, kind of thing. But and yeah, he spent loads of time doing it up. But, I think it's just him at Gorgeous now. You know, I think he's just kind of just.
This piece of Thwaites has moved to America.
Yeah,
as well,
and I think he just kind of does jobs that I don't know. He still he loves working. And he's I mean, I haven't worked for him for 2 or 3 years now, but.
But I tried searching him. Chris, if you go into Google and put Chris Palmer director, nothing comes up.
Really?
Yeah. I had to try and hunt him down. The only representation I could see with him was America.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe he has completely shut Gorgeous down in the UK now.
I think there might be. Yeah. I don't know. Someone told me he's gone to America.
Yeah.
I'd like to
got a place in LA as well.
Right. I'd like to have got him as a guest. That's why I'm so curious.
I think he spends his time between here and LA, but he's got a place in. Got a beautiful. I haven't been there, but it's a beautiful house in LA. You know, they filmed Tom Ford movie Single Man.
Oh yeah, is that his house?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That is a beautiful house. Yeah. So why didn't he do films then?
I think he. I don't know why exactly, but I know he was keen to. As was Frank. He had some scripts, and you know, he's always had sort of keen to. You know, he'd follow up with scripts and write stuff himself and get the rights to various movie scripts and stuff. So I don't know why it never actually happened.
It's such a slow burner, isn't it?
Yeah,
for that?
It's a weird. I mean,
it's that transition from commercials to films is so hard for directors. I think there's only a few that get it right.
I know. I think he went off to. Did he go off to LA for a while to concentrate on doing that? I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't know why he didn't. He should have done, because he would have been brilliant. And I would have loved to have seen a Frank Budget movie.
Yeah.
It would have been incredible.
Yeah,
He did a great advert for Guinness or Stella Artois. It was kind of crazy, surrealist.
Black and white.
Black and white, yeah.
Was that the one with the...
It's like a chair falling over and ants over all. Like, it's just really weird. It's just completely like a surrealist movie.
Because the one, what are we talking about? Jonathan Glazer? Oh, no, sorry, I remember the Jonathan Glazer one.
Yeah.
I know the one you mean. There was like a magnifying glass or something.
Yeah,
and it's like surrealist. It was a take on surrealist sort of filmmaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I thought, God, if he did a film like that, it would have been amazing. Yeah. Thanks, just done just a completely bonkers surrealist movie.
Because the one I really love that's like that, another Guinness commercial, is the one Jonathan Glazer did, when the horse is laughing on its back and they have the little hole and they all run up to the hole and start laughing hysterically and fall back. Have you not seen that? Oh my God, it's unbelievably good.
Yeah.
It's just, even now, because some, of course, ads don't really age that well, a lot of them.
Yeah.
This one really does.
Yeah.
It's worth searching out. So you kind of like, where you got to meet these directors and work with them, was it, am I right? Did you kind of, were you on a set presence and they?
Yeah, I guess. Chris, I started working with them when I was same with Frank, when I was a loader.
Mm.
And just got to know them that way and sort of, just then just kind of came matey with Chris. So I sort of hung out with him a little bit as well. And then, don't know, just ended up writing for him.
I think it's because they feel really comfortable with you.
Yeah,
I think that's
maybe,
your secret.
Yeah.
I think you can get them to relax and trust you.
Yeah, maybe.
Because you've got a lot of repeat directors. Like Siri does a lot of work with you.
Yeah.
And Chris did a fair bit of work. I can see
I'm not, yeah, but I never kind of, also I'm one of these people that been in the industry long enough now that I do get directors that I've repeatedly worked with, but it doesn't bother me if they could use some DOPs are I've worked with someone and they're using someone else and they get really wound up by it, like, what have I done wrong, and start thinking about like, oh God, did I fuck up the last job, and it's like, I think it's healthy, you know, you can never, it's like even when you're a focus puller and a DOP uses another focus puller in a job, you just think that's how it is sometimes, you know, you can't, or sometimes you stop working as a director or as a camera assistant, as a DOP, and you never work with them again. And you think, oh, why did that bit?
That's just how it is. Well, my agent always tells me.
Then someone else comes out, or you start working with someone else. It's not like.
Yeah.
It's a very fluid industry, and it's that's how it is.
You go on a partial journey with someone for a bit, and you kind of end in it. Because that's what happened with me and Simon. I shot all of his early commercials, actually, HLA.
Yeah.
And then Simon said, one day, it's very dignified. He said to me, I'm thinking of spreading my wings a bit and working with some other DOPs.
Yeah.
And I was
nice you said that.
Yeah, because a lot of people, directors don't tell you that because they feel so uncomfortable about it. He's a very brave man, Simon. He's got really good integrity, and he just said it to me straight, and I went, and we did work together again.
Yeah.
Actually, the last job I did with him, I actually did second unit for another DOP that he brought over from another country. And I was saying to my agent, it'd be lovely to work with Simon. I tried to not sort of feel jilted by it, slighted by it.
You can't. I mean, you can't get, you know, you hear some stories of people getting really upset by it.
We came on set afterwards because I was doing pack shots, and he came on set, gave me a hug, and said, I knew I could trust you with this. Cause,
perfect, there you go.
Yeah, so in a way, it was a compliment, actually.
Yeah, massively.
Yeah, so I've got a few things to cover. Mm-hmm. So let's talk, should we talk about influences first?
Okay.
You said, when you were a child, you had a real sense of cinema quite early on.
Just general cinema and culture, and I kind of always grew up with my family.
Was your family quite artistic?
Yeah.
Was there always the kind of cool music playing in the house?
Yeah, always good with a complete range of music, which was nice. And my dad and sister were very good at piano, so always somebody on the piano playing.
Yeah, that's nice. It's a nice background.
Yeah, it's nice.
Ambience. Yeah.
And then my grandma was always around, and my grandma's from Georgia. Oh, thank you. It's from Georgia, south of Russia, Georgia, not Georgia. So had a bit of cultural influence there as well. And she was Georgian, my grandfather was Polish. So
are you into Polish and Russian cinema?
A bit, not as much as I should be. I should be more. Georgian cinema, I don't know that much, but I've heard it's pretty good. But
Yeah, I haven't heard.
See, no, I mean, but some have. But I mean, obviously the classic stuff like Tarkovsky and stuff like that. But I've seen a few amazing Polish films.
Do you like Krzysztof Kieślowski?
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
He was probably my favourite growing up. Yeah. He influenced me quite a lot, actually, when I was growing up, you know, that whole film school. The one thing I would say...
Did you get film school then?
Yeah, but I didn't really get any hands-on experience of making films and all of that. I think you learned that on the film set, right?
Yeah.
But what I did get is an appreciation for cinema, for world cinema.
Yeah.
So before I went there, I was into the obvious Martin Scorsese's and, you know...
Yeah, that's the same as me as a teenager, the usual sort of...
Load. But then...
Brilliant. I mean, being into those kind of people, I think, because they were incredible directors.
I went to see Goodfellas at the cinema.
Oh, such a great film. Well, recently or when it
came
out?
No, when it came out. And it was a proper ride for me.
I was probably like 17 or 18 when it came out, and... Yeah, it was the same proper ride. I was like, this is...
Yeah.
I think I went to cinema about 3 times to see it.
Yeah. The biggest films that have influenced me have been probably Goodfellas, Blade Runner, and I'd say actually American films, this is. Yeah. I'd say...
Apocalypse Now?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
For me, I think it's just the epicness of it. You know, before any visual effects or anything like that, it was real. You know, there's a jets coming in and napalming a
war. Yeah, they're fighting a war, weren't they, up the coast? And they
board all the helicopters and stuff. Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's great documentary, isn't it? Hearts of Darkness.
Hearts of Darkness. Yeah, it's his wife, I think. Shot on 16mm. Yeah. I mean, but I like the stories of Victorio Storaro. Apparently, he was so sort of elegant that he was wearing, I don't know if you saw the pictures, but he's always wearing white linen.
Oh.
And it's like they said that if he fell off a ladder into mud, he'd emerge without any shit on him. Do you know what I mean? It's like he had that kind of...
Yeah.
And he was a young guy because he, you know, The Conformist, he shot that when he was like, I don't know, 25 or something. Wow. Incredibly. He did his first film, maybe a bit older than that, but I remember him.
Yeah.
He just had this incredible talent.
Yeah, amazing talent.
But it's and to have it, because you know he got into all his philosophies around colour and you know, he had quite a lot, because with the Apocalypse Now, it's all about the technology coming and fighting nature. So the two cultures were nature being the Vietnamese and Americans were technology, and it's like how those two things met.
Yeah.
And so he would always want to have like some kind of through line to the lighting. So the lighting with the Americans was always like artificial lighting, and with the Viet Cong, it was always... natural.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I thought that's...
Yeah, it's interesting.
Do you ever have philosophies around when you approach a job? What's your process of when you approach a job? Do you kind of mull over it in your mind for a bit and come up with a lighting strategy? Or?
Yeah, generally. It varies from job to job, really. But generally, I will... If I have the opportunity to, I will. If it's just... Depending on what the job is, you know. If it's an advert for Tesco and a supermarket, slightly different. But
yeah. Do you have a starting point? You get sent the boards for commercials. We get sent the boards. We look at the treatment,
or sometimes the boards. You first see them on the recce, or even after the recce, because they come out from what
you
go to on the recce, depending on the director.
I like that. I like to go on the recce with my Artemis and to find every frame that we're shooting. Because when you see boards and they're trying to force something in that location, it's not going to yield.
Yeah, or just isn't. Yeah, it just isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So I try and do that. But then sometimes it's quite hard because, you know, you turn up in a location and they're going, we're going to move the bed over there. We can clear this out. We can build a fake wall here. We can do this. And you think, well, there's no point in me taking a photo because there's nothing here to take a photo of.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But as long as you have talked to as a director exactly how you're going to do it. But
so what I also like about the Artemis approach is to try and get a director to think in terms of frames.
Yeah,
because I think some directors have 360 heads. They go into a location, they get seduced by the atmosphere of the location and go, well, actually, that's what we're shooting.
Yeah.
So you lose, you know, particularly we did a job recently with churches, and all the churches look amazing.
Yeah.
But when you framed up what we're actually shooting,
you're only seeing,
there's only one that actually worked practically. Yeah. So
it's, I wish as a DOP you had more of that option that you were involved in directors' recces as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Because every time you turn up on a location, you think,
how do they choose this?
How do they choose this location?
And one thing I find really frustrating is that on the, you know, the pictures you get from the locations companies, they don't have a sun path on there.
No.
Why not just put a sun path on there? It's such a simple thing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when we're looking through the pictures, at least we can work out.
Yeah, I quite often just Google Maps it and then find out where it is.
Yeah, that's a smart move. I didn't think of that. Another lesson I've learned.
But it's still, you know, it's easy for them to just do, or at least have a, you know,
north. This is north. Yeah, that's all it would need. Each photograph. Yeah. This is north here. Yeah. I'm really with you on that. It's like I used to actually, the directors that I did get kind of like in bed with, you know, the ones that I was kind of having a long relationship with in filming wise, like Sarah. She would bring me. She'd get me out to a country full of directors recce, so we'd choose, you know, should allow my input. Which
that's
is great.
Why, you know, when you do work abroad, you fly out and you tend to, for a three-day shoot, let's say, you're out for 8 days or something, let's say. So you get involved in, quite often, directors recce, you get involved in, obviously, tech recce, and all the days in between. So when you, second you're on that airplane, you are immersed in just that
job. It's a
job,
focus, isn't it?
You're so focused on that job.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about
your little kid at home or whatever,
you're so immersed, which I love, you know, and actually you that's when I think you really build up a good relationship with director and stuff, because you can really you can really help them as well, because you're there for them and to help them visualize what's in their head. So if you, the more time you have with them to do that, and
there's like three stages to a production, isn't there? There's a prep, then there's the actual shoot, and then there's a post, right? And I find that the producer's like, it's like doing a relay race. The producer starts off with a relationship with the director, and then the moment the DOP turns up, it becomes the baton gets handed to the DOP.
Yeah.
And then after that, we hand the baton on to the editor, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, emotionally, one of the best bits of advice I was given when I started out was try and get a director to emotionally need you, to be kind of good to hang out with and to be, you know, to feel supported by, you know.
That's the thing. I think to feel supported is very key.
Yeah.
Which sometimes with some directors is a challenge. But
being,
and also just get on with them, you know, they're getting it from above, you know, they're getting it from the client and agency sometimes, and so to have someone that there's on their side and, you know, seems in the same hymn book as them really helps.
Because they're holding the baby, you know. I kind of taught myself into forgiving bad behaviour on set from directors, because they've got so much pressure, so much responsibility, and they're holding they don't have the same careers we have, you know. Anyone out there now, learn, please know that a director's career is a lot shorter than the DOP's career, right?
Yeah.
So they have their moment, and then they become irrelevant quite quickly. So I feel kind of feel for them when it comes to that last job could be their last job. It really genuinely could be. And they have to make it as best as they, you know, have to get a 7 out of 10 idea up to a 9, or a 4 out of 10 idea up to a 7 or whatever.
It's, it's not easy.
Yeah.
I remember my sister saying to me when I was like 17 or something, she said, Jim, never be a director. DOP, definitely, because DOP can work every week. You know, director, if you're lucky, do 3 or 4 jobs a year.
Do you think it's the best role on the film set?
I think so.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a huge amount of competition now, because everyone's cottoned onto that.
Yeah.
There's more DOPs than directors now.
Yeah.
When I went to film school...
there's also a shitload of directors as well.
Yeah.
You know.
But when I went to film school, everyone wanted to be a director, which actually allowed me to go claim DOP, and I got the best projects because of that.
I think that's partly due to the revolution that got brought around by cameras like the 5D, which I'm very pro, because I think it made filmmaking available to the masses. You know, if you wanted to make a film before, you needed to be able to afford film and 16 film and editing.
Yeah, it's a democratization of
And suddenly having the ability that anyone can either buy a 2 grand camera. Now you can do it on your iPhone.
That's right.
You know, and actually be able to, anyone can make it. If anyone's got a good idea, anyone can make a film.
Yeah,
no excuses. You can, anyone can do it. So
you can get an app on the iPhone now. I'm looking at the best cinematography app the other day, and one of them is like, gives you depth of field, gives you everything.
Yeah, I've never used it. It's got this cinematic mode, which I think does depth of field.
Yeah.
But it's like portrait mode for cinema, I think. So anyone can make a film now, which is brilliant.
Mm.
But what it means is. There's a lot more people doing it, but that's fine, because if everybody wants to turn around and say, I'm a DOP, fine, but there's only ever going to be X amount.
Well, it's a meritocracy
and
in a way.
Get a career out of it.
Yeah, it's a meritocracy, you know, it's like talent shines through, to shine through.
Yeah. What's that called? Meritocracy.
Yeah, merit. You know, based on merit, rather than sort of like some kind of nepotism or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I used to, when the 5D came out, I used to shoot loads on it. I loved it. So it's such a good...
It has a kind of creamy look. Did you find that?
Yes, and I really like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And also just, you could... And Martin Hill, who I was assisting for and operating for at the time the 5D came out, was a massive fan of it as well. He was one of the first DOPs I know that
he really embraced
it. In commercials.
Yeah.
And because you could just... You're so small, no one knows you're filming.
Yeah, because he's
so unobtrusive and... You know, I shot a thing with Simon, actually, operated on. party card, was it? Advert at Heathrow Airport. It's
all
about
people hugging. I remember it. Yeah.
So that was shot on film.
And he used to creeps up to people, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Martin? And then just goes around the back, kind of sidles around, and then comes around when he's got that 35mm close.
But that was 35mm film, and that was so it's really hard because
that was shot on film. Was it?
That was shot on film.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and that was so you're capturing moments. That moment when the doors open, it was all done with real people. With a nice set up. That moment when somebody sees their family, like, you've got to preempt it because the second it's actually really hard to do. Shot quite a bit of film, but now something like that on 5Ds would be
you wouldn't even need to.
No one would. So like you say, so inconspicuous and so just.
Yeah,
you know, it could be this close to someone, and someone doesn't know you're there.
Yeah, like you were saying at the beginning of our conversation about the new Canon camera that's come out that shoots 8K.
Yeah,
and shoots really good still.
Yeah, the R5C.
Yeah,
5C. Yeah,
the era of the 5C now.
Yeah, well, they bought the R5, but it kept overheating apparently or something. But
oh, really?
It's got a big fan on the back of it.
Yeah,
but it's great. Yeah.
So let's segue into talking about lenses then.
Yeah.
So I've noticed when I look through all your work, I noticed there is you don't stick to one lens.
No.
You shop around a bit, don't you?
But I do like lenses.
I notice there's not a lot of anamorphic on your... It's a lot of spherical.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, really. I mean, sometimes it's just... Yeah, I don't know.
When someone like Steve Annis...
Or sometimes I shoot stuff anamorphic and then crop it 16:9.
Yeah.
But generally... Yeah, there isn't a lot, is there?
No, I mean, that's... Yeah,
I shoot more anamorphic.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly with the social media requirements now, anamorphic's not such a smart move. If you're going to do 9:16 out of anamorphic...
I always thought... Going to give away my secret here is because if you think of a if you've got a film camera so if you turn the anamorphic lens sideways on a 16:9 frame, put the camera on its side basically, have the anamorphic sideways, you could extend the 16:9 by 2 times anamorphic, so it would become essentially a 18:16, so near enough a square frame.
Right, interesting.
So for social media, you could.
That's a really
put
clever idea.
On, but streaks and everything, and the flares would be the ovals would be.
Yeah,
up
you
and
need
down
to check the pins on the mount as well. You need to sort somehow get the pins.
But I mean, a lot of those lenses actually have
four registration
you know,
holds. So you can just rotate them around.
Always thought of doing that, just film everything on camera on its side for Instagram and just use a full.
I used to have a thing called Linhof Technorama, which is a really wide angle stills camera, medium format. And I saw there's a gallery exhibition.
Is that like the Wide-Lux type thing?
Yeah, it shoots medium format, but rather than one frame.
Does it scans, does it?
No, it's not that one.
Oh,
no,
right.
No, it shoots about 3 frames simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
So it's a big old lump.
Amazing,
But I went to a gallery show with that was the camera they used, and they did it all. And it's just amazing how limited that is in the world.
Yeah.
We kind of all see... A little bit landscapey.
Yeah, well, eyes are next to each other, not above each other.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I always say. It's like whenever I take stills, I generally always take them landscape.
Portrait.
I never hold my camera portrait. And
but have you noticed how the new generation?
I know it's everything portrait.
Everything's portrait.
Really, it's really annoying.
Yeah. So because the way that I see is not portrait.
That's what I always say to people when they're taking photographs. It's like, your eyes are next to each other.
Yeah.
Above each
other. Not above each other. Yeah. Yeah. Unless you're drunk one night.
Yeah.
On the floor. Yeah, so lenses then. So do you have a favourite make of lenses?
Not really. I mean,
I kind of
go through them, try. I mean, I love lenses, especially with digital, obviously, lenses with more character.
Yeah.
I've
made a few notes on the lenses.
I'm a focus puller's nightmare because I love shooting
wide
open.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about because there's a few jobs that I think it really added
Super speeds, I think, were brilliant. You know, when everyone's Super 35s, Zeiss Super Speeds are just. I mean, I remember when I was younger, somebody offered me a set for about $5,000.
Oh,
I was like,
mate, you must regret that.
You get a whole set of lenses in a suitcase this big.
Yeah.
You know,
and they go on anything.
Small,
they go on a drone, they go on anything. Yeah.
Such good lenses.
Yeah, they're amazing lenses.
And they've got lovely character.
Yeah.
So I use
them
quite
a
bit. A
milkiness as well,
don't
they? Yeah.
And then when you go full frame, you're a bit more limited. So.
Do you. K35s, is it?
K35s, I like. I sometimes use a newer Canon. They did those Sumires,
right?
Which are like the supposedly modern K35.
Yeah.
Which are kind of got a bit of character to them.
Yeah.
But nowhere near as much as K35, but they're full frame and they're fast.
Yeah.
Have
you heard of the Dream lenses?
I've got one.
Oh, you got one?
Yeah,
what
got
one
got
have
one.
You got?
I've got I've got a Canon 50mm 0.95.
Yeah.
Then I've got a 35mm whatever it is, 1.5.
It's the deranged finder that fits with it. Yeah.
So it's a Canon.
Have you got them rehoused?
No.
No, because I just literally sent them to True Lens to get mine rehoused.
Oh, really? Yeah. And then I've also got the, which you can't, not got a Canon 85mm, but I've got a Russian equivalent to it. It's a rangefinder.
Yeah.
85mm, I think, F2.
Yeah. Have you used that on any jobs?
Yeah, I used it on a shelter advert I did over Christmas.
Is that on your website?
Might not be on there. I haven't updated my website in about a year.
Oh, really?
Maybe I have. It's the thing I did with Jamie Reffin.
Yeah.
Smuggler.
Well, pop it on there because then if you can watch it. Yeah,
okay, yeah. I'll update my.
Yeah, because the Dream lenses are very, very special. The first time I saw
them. I love them. They're great.
The first time I saw them was it was Zac Efron. Army of the Undead.
Oh yeah,
and it's all shot on red.
Zack Snyder.
Snyder. Sorry.
Yeah, that was all shot on them. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was all shot on red.
Yeah.
Which is very digital format, very sharp format, and it just looked so dreamy. And I was like,
nightmare for the focus pullers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And aliens or zombies running at you.
Yeah.
I haven't rehoused mine. They're currently Leica mount.
Right.
And no, a Leica mount, but I've got a Leica to E-mount adapter. So with the Sony Venice.
Yeah.
If you take the PL mount off, all Sony Venices are Sony E mount underneath.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah.
Which is really close to the sensor, but it means you can put any lens, any pretty much E mount you can get adapters to.
Yeah.
Leica M, you can get adapters to.
Well, I did a really crazy thing, and I got my Leica M's because I was really into Noctilux lenses.
Yeah.
And I got them rehoused, and I went to this guy called Kim Camera in Korea because he's the only one that could go near them, and he really balls them up.
Did he?
Really badly. Nice, It took about 2 years to get them.
Yeah.
And I thought he was just going to, you know, because I had no, what was I thinking? Because just the glass alone, because I bought all the glass new and it was like £30,000 worth of glass, just stills glass. And then, you know, sent them over there, didn't hear from him for, you know, he was terrible at keeping in contact. So he would ignore my emails for about, sometimes up to two, three months. And I'd think, oh, I've lost all my lenses. And then he'd get in. I just literally received back the last lens like last week. So now I can kind of put a line to that.
They've done well or not?
No, really badly. Actually, it's funny because when I did a couple of sets, because I got these old Leica straw coating lens, the old very early Leicas have a straw coating rather than a kind of mauve coating. And I got those done because I had an old, I think called Nisco Optic, which is an anamorphic adapter.
Yeah, I know,
1.4 adapter.
Yeah.
And I wanted to house it all so it looked like a proper bit of kit.
Yeah.
And I sent them over to him as well with my ends. My ends are a huge investment, and that, the other one.
So the adapter is an anamorphic adapter.
Yeah.
Is that from projection lenses, or are they?
Yeah, it's the ISCO. It's a projection lens. Yeah. So, but because it's got a kind of straw cover, a coating, and there's a guy called Melting Point or something. He's a dog shit lens.
I know the guy. Yeah. David Gale or something.
Yeah, David Gale. Yeah. He advised me to get straw coated Leicas because he said that's a perfect match for the straw coating on the end. So I got those back and they were actually a lot better. But the first
from the same guy.
Yeah. So he's improved his production using my lenses as an experiment, basically.
Right.
But the first ones I sent him were the most valuable ones.
Yeah.
So then I brought them back to optical support. And there's a guy there called Tio who's been coating them with. They get coated in. Like what's a frying pan Teflon?
Oh right.
So you coat them in Teflon to try.
PFOAs. Teflon. Teflon's like one of those chemicals that
everyone has in their body now.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, the thing that the safe levels of it. Safe level that means if you should have this. If you have a higher than this level, you're likely to get cancer.
Right.
Every everywhere on the planet, rain has a higher level than that safe level.
Right.
So wherever you are on the planet.
You're going to get Teflon poisoning. Yeah.
You're going to get PFOA poisoning.
And chances are you get cancer.
And you think all these communities, all these places in the world that collect rainwater for drinking.
It's gone into the water system.
Yeah, it's gone into all our system. Our reservoirs all being filled with this stuff above safety limits.
Yeah. There's a great movie about that, actually.
Yeah, Dark Waters.
Yeah, what's his name? The brilliant actor. Mark Ruffalo, yeah.
That's good.
I thought that was a really good film.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, really frightening.
Yeah, anyway, my lenses have got that poison in them as well.
But
they work better
just
now.
Just don't lick them.
Yeah, exactly. I did actually have a set of these lenses called, they're really early Pentax lenses called Pentax Takumars.
Oh, Takumars. Takumars are now Super Takumars. They're lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, and they've all got yellow coatings to say they're radioactive, the lenses.
Yeah. A couple of early Canons were. radioactive as well.
You have to put them out in the sun, and then and the sun, the UV of the sun
takes the yellow out.
Yeah. But I remember I was so worried about those. I took them to a kinesiologist to test them, muscle test me.
So small amounts.
I know. He said to me, just don't sleep with them, is his advice. Yeah. And I was like, oh shit, I better stop sleeping with them then.
I've got some of those dog shit lenses actually. He did these. Converted
Trumps.
From
they were called Trumps.
Yeah, Trumps. But
and he had to rename them, didn't he?
Oh, did he?
When Trump came into power, he had to rename them.
So I've got these 35, 15, 85, which are the same lens, but an adapter that goes on the front.
Yeah.
And then he brought out the 28, and I didn't get it. And I keep messaging him saying, have you got a 28 front?
He's terrible getting back to you because he's so busy.
Yeah.
And he's like quite a unique guy, really. He's like, there's very few lens gurus in the country now. Yeah. You know? So he's.
And then, they're good though.
He does a big anamorphic adapter. Have you seen?
I know he was going to, and I don't know what happened to that because I know when he was working on designing it, and then he just kind of went quiet about it.
Well, he's only made a few of them, and everyone who's got them won't give them up because apparently they're better than Primos. I mean,
really?
He was claiming so. I mean, I hadn't seen them, but a lot. You know, he spent a long time developing that, and it became cost ineffective for him.
Yeah, I think he was selling them. I remember quite a lot he was selling them for.
Yeah, it was like $5,000 or something, maybe
six
more.
$6,000, I think, something like that. I remember thinking, but actually now in hindsight,
it would have been a bargain. Yeah, because the optic is about that size.
Now, it's crazy to get like K35s go for like $270,000.
I mean, that's way overpriced in my opinion. I have a theory around that. I think that what happened with the super speeds is because the super speeds are Zeiss, right? So Zeiss made a move and got into cinema.
Yeah.
And then Canon wanted to do a similar move because the K35s came out at the same time as Super Speeds.
Yeah, they're just rehoused.
That's right, FDs. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's what my theory is.
Canon
didn't bother redesigning the lens at all. They just rehoused it and called it. And that's the only reason they work on large format. So
a set of FDs with the aspheric ones and the fast 24 and 55 and 85. They go for.
Shot up in
ridiculous.
Yeah,
I looked at getting a 24mm 1.4. That's just so technical, boring everyone senses.
Not our audience.
A couple of years ago to buy one of these Canon 24mm. It was like not even two grand, like £1,500. And I was like, that is ridiculous.
Yeah, but now it's like $6,000.
No, now it's like 15.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's like $10,000, $15,000.
Right. Yeah.
It's like fucking hell.
Yeah. Yeah, I bought one actually.
Did you?
Yeah, and because I'm friendly with Gavin at True Lens, and I always phone him up and say, what lenses should I be buying? What are the ones going to be?
I've always been a fan of, and actually I've used them quite a few jobs, the Zeiss Contax stills lenses.
Yeah.
Because they are very similar to the
very
super
similar,
speeds.
Yeah.
And they're full frame. Some of them aren't quite as fast, but the key kind of ones in the middle
are. Yeah.
And I love them.
The ones that I've got into, I've been trying to coveting these lenses for quite a while, and I started shooting. In fact, the last two jobs I did both of them with this lens set. Did you ever use swing and tilt lenses, the Arri swing tilts?
Yeah.
Because I think they're all Mamiya or Minolta or something.
Oh,
lenses.
They, yeah.
Because they're large format, medium format lenses.
Oh, Mamiya,
Because they cover.
I haven't used them in ages.
To be honest. But they cover all the large formats, right? Because by virtue of the fact they're medium format lenses to begin with.
Yeah.
So they're kind of pretty cool, actually. Yeah. And I've been like tinkering with them, but the focus pullers hate me.
Yeah.
Because they can't sit on the monitor with their little, very expensive follow focus. They have to stand by the camera with me.
God, I miss that, having focus.
Because they used to do their job.
If you wanted something done, you could just whisper to them, rather than creating attention. And it's just quite.
Yeah, they sort of hide off in another part of the set, making themselves really comfortable.
Yeah.
Have a little shared, monitor.
Big monitor now.
Which, incidentally, they're hiring out to production for about $1,000, more than the DOP's usually getting paid.
Yeah.
It's all quite a bit, a bit sort of.
Yeah. That's all right. I don't mind them getting their own kit on it.
Yeah. So do you own any of your own? Well, you own lenses, right?
I've got lenses, but I only use them if they're the right job to use them on. They're generally mainly stills mount lenses, so they're Canon mount. I think I've got a Canon to Arri. Alexa mount. So I can unscrew the front of Alexa and put the Canon mount on. So I get them on job sometimes. No, I filters and...
Oh, let's talk about filters. What's your favourite, what filter combinations do you tend to use?
Very rarely actually use filters. I just carry filters if I need NDs, grads. Mm. Diffusion-wise, I've got Black Satins I sometimes use. Or
what are they, Schneider?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or no, Tiffin. Sorry,
Tiffin. I've never heard of those.
Or what are the other ones I've got?
Black Promise,
Glimmer Glass.
Glimmer Glass, yeah.
I've got some black pro missing, old 4x4 format left over from I used to, when I was an assistant, every time I go and test at Arri or all the rental houses, I go, have you got any, what, have you got any scratch filters? Because every time you get, they chuck them in a drawer and you have a drawer full of old, so
Did exactly the same with Panavision.
Sets of 6x6 and 4x4 filters for spending years, just every time taking one.
We should do some trades because I've done exactly the same. I was quite friendly with Panavision when I started my career.
Actually, I never use them. 6x6, I use some, but 4x4.
Well, I got a bunch of mine cut down to PV because
that's
thought,
good. That's a good idea.
Yeah, but you've got to find the right glass person.
But then you've got loads of stuff like a set of 85s. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I've got loads
really,
of that.
Not really very useful anymore.
There might be something in the future, who knows?
Yeah.
It's like a kind of tobacco, isn't it, or something? You might be the odd. Do you use much colour in there?
No, not really. Never. It's just a
tiny touch of diffusion and let the lens do the rest.
Diffusion, really. I try and do that with a lens because you can't emulate what a lens is doing with a filter.
Filters are quite heavy-handed, I find. You know, so the more I try and do it in the lighting.
And the aberrations you get within a lens, you just can't replicate in a filter. You know.
I very rarely use them.
Yeah, and going back to shooting wide open, that's part of the reason why I like shooting wide open is not because of the narrow depths of field, is because that's when the lenses get a bit fucked up.
Yeah,
and I love it. The more you're pushing a lens and it becomes a bit soft or things go a bit weird.
That's when it looks interesting.
It's when some lenses you stop down a little bit.
Yeah, it will get to, like K35. It's like 2.8. It's a completely different lens set to 1.4.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'd like to talk to you again. Yeah. We sort of didn't quite get into it deep enough earlier. So influences, like cultural kind of influences and maybe film influences that, you know, did you have a favourite film growing up or a favourite director?
I mean, from a cultural wise, I think, okay, so let's talk about cultural influence first. I think, I don't know really. I mean, I sort of...
Your family were a big cultural influence.
So, my family were a big cultural influence. And actually I've done a lot of travelling.
Did you inherit?
Working and stuff. So, going away and being abroad and seeing different cultures and stuff
has
been a massive influence for me. And also just way of life in a way. You realise how other people live. And so that's influenced me in the lifestyle, not necessarily in my work.
See, the thing that's so wonderful about our job, I think, is when you do go to a foreign country, you don't experience it as a tourist. You experience it as a local because you work with local crew, right?
Yeah.
Do you take crew around with you or do you stick to a local...
Depends.
Yeah, depends.
Sometimes, generally nowadays, very rarely get to take.
I never get to take anyone.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, I've got a camera assistant, Rob Gilmore, who's loads for me quite a lot, but he's great because if I'm going up a mountain in Mongolia and he'll come with me and he'll test all the gear before we go hook up and he'll be an assistant and he'll do the dragging and dropping the files at the end of each day. And so just having one person who can do everything, probably pull focus myself for a job like that, but he's just an all-round just extra, you know. I sometimes argue for him to come on certain jobs and production go, it's a bit of a squeeze. But when he does come...
It saves him money.
That was so much better, you know. Yeah. He organises a carne, he just... helps with all the gear, you know, wraps it all up, looks after it all.
Yeah.
You know, they just don't have to worry about any of that.
Yeah. My person like that is my gaffer, Josh. He's a young guy, 25. Well, I started working with him when he was 25, and we grew together with the lighting systems that we use now, the Keynap Learner and the Dado lighting systems.
Yeah.
So he knows this way around the menus of the Keynap, I bet, and faster than anyone. And also with the light stream, he sets a reflector quicker than anyone.
That's the problem with the LED lighting system is that now you need someone in the lighting department who is just
kind of like a desktop,
completely off, like a desktop. But just because there's so many times you go, you want to change color, you want to chase a couple of lights, or you want to do something. And it is sometimes quite a tricky, if you don't know what you're doing, it's like you see a load of sparks, Hank's scratching their heads around an iPad.
Yeah.
You know, to have someone just go,
But it's younger generation, I'm just all over that.
Incredible. Yeah, I did a music video. I can't remember his name. It was brilliant. I should use him again. And it was like...
He was a gaffer, was he?
He was a gaffer. So he was a freebie or...
How
low,
was he?
Young. Like early 20s.
Yeah.
And he was just brilliant. We were shooting in mid-take. I'd be going, okay, let's change that colour to whatever. Or the director would be talking to him and doing colour changes as we're filming here. And he'd just do it as we go, seamlessly. Or, you know, there's a lot of gaffers just...
Yeah, I mean, we are a product of our culture a little bit. Yeah. And so when things move on,
yeah,
then, you know, some gaffers are really good at embracing new cultures, yeah, new technology, but a lot of them are sort of, yeah, set in their ways a little,
yeah,
bit.
Yeah.
So I found when I was moving from traditional lighting to the more, what I call precision lighting, with the, yeah, colour science of Kinaflow and the optics of Daylight, what I wanted to do is something similar to what you do. Is I just like the ambience of the room. So I like to bring the room down in ambience, yeah, by putting nets on the windows and just bring, yeah, the whole thing, and then use really precise lights to get,
yeah,
the shape.
Yeah.
Rather than blast it with a load of light and then put a massive ND in the camera and,
yeah,
end up with that reductive thing I was talking about earlier. That doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So what you're doing is interesting like that. If, for instance, you want a sunny, bright sunny feel, or you wanted a bit of flare, or...
Well, I still use small lights inside because, yeah, like I said, I use nets on windows and stuff, yeah, to bring it. And so I just bring everything down.
Yeah.
The problem I come into, and I wanted to ask you about this actually, is when it's exteriors. So,
yeah,
for example, that job with Siri with the Steadicam shot.
Yeah.
Because I noticed a lot of your exteriors look really natural.
Yeah. Generally because they just are.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, yeah, I mean, that there's a football, you know, there's a comedy football thing where he's giving everyone...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was, yeah, brilliant script. Yeah. I thought it was very funny.
Yeah, it was good.
But that had a... When he was doing the group talk, that all had sort of backlight on it, and then a lot of the wide shots didn't. So did you like those, or was it just you planned that around the light?
I think I might have lit... I might have just had one light for that.
And what would you... if you're doing exterior, what would your light of choice be?
It depends on the location, but probably like a...
A 9K or 18K
or something like that.
Yeah, I like 9s because they're one less spark needs to put them on a stand.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so...
it depends on it. Depends what it is. But, yes, and something like that, if we can get rid of the 4.
Yeah, so you like... Again, like me, you like smaller lights.
I keep things smaller where possible.
Yeah.
But then if you're lighting a bigger area as well,
yeah,
you know...
And do you ever say to production, you know what, I'm just going to let it go?
This is the thing is, at the end of the day, budgets are getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
And where they're working as a team, and I've got to... help them out as much as I can,
yeah,
so I try and keep things small,
yeah, same here,
it helps them out.
And that's,
you know,
the Martin Hill philosophy as well,
yeah,
right? So you probably learned that a bit
off his
approach. He's like I think he's like a street photographer, the way he approaches things.
Yeah, he is, yeah. And your photography background,
yeah, oh, that makes a lot of sense, yeah, to me.
But I think sometimes I see people's Instagram or whatever, and they're on set and there's like a whole bank of 18Ks. I'm like, fucking hell, how did they manage to wangle that? If I said, oh, when I bank of 18, I'll just get certain that.
Yeah,
can't do that. And actually, also locations nowadays pissing me off at locations. When you get a location, it's like fourth floor. It's,
yeah.
And we can't have a generator here.
Yeah.
So you've got to work in your means, kind of.
That's
thing,
right. So. One of my solutions around that is we got these. They're coming actually from Germany now. With these power. What's it called? You know, servo powered reflectors.
Oh, so
you
can put them on a high
yeah,
stand
and
ping up straight up.
It's a parallel beam, goes straight up to it, no light loss at all, into a second floor window.
That's great, and you can
you've got little controls down.
It's amazing. Yeah.
So that, yeah, I'll have to show you that, because you should come back when you've got time and actually look at some of this stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's move on now to advice for, because we didn't really get into, we keep skirting around the influences. Yeah, so I think
I can show you influences very quickly was.
Yeah.
Usual sort of people as I grew up, you know, being a teen, you know, Scorsese and all those kind of era of directors, Coppola,
David Lynch,
definitely, yeah.
That kind of film school generation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that kind of coming through the sort of 70s and 80s.
Yeah,
where
Easy Riders, Raging Bulls.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of went, as they say in that book, sort of the auteur kind of era of directors.
Yeah.
Where they,
I mean, the thing that's so, that's my favourite period of cinema as well, and the reason I love it so much is because big scripts were getting made, but they're getting made like independent films.
Yeah,
and now you don't have that. You just have the sort of, you know, the big kind of,
It all goes down to showing audiences, and they've got to reshoot whole things of films. And actually, you know, a lot of crew I work with still work on big movies, and just don't enjoy. Everyone I know who works in commercials wants to do movies, and everyone who works on movies wants to do commercials. And somebody said a good thing was, working on a big film now, in the old days we used to call it a film game. Now it's a film business.
Yeah,
right. So that's quite good.
Yeah,
it's just not fun anymore.
Yeah.
You know, on set, it's not as... And for me, that's one of the big things, is enjoy it and have fun on set.
Yeah.
Just, you know...
Otherwise, why are we doing this? Because it is actually quite a stressful, hard job, and we work very long hours as well. Yeah. It's another thing that I liked is 12-hour rule that's come in now.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I start shutting down after about 12 hours on set. I can't. It's a real struggle.
I'm always very lucky. I always tend to do shoots that don't have really long days. I don't know what it is, and always work with really nice directors.
So, advice for young DOPs.
Advice for young DOPs. I would say,
can I interrupt you? What's the best bit of advice you've ever been given?
best bit, it was probably a similar kind of advice. The DOP I used to work for said to me, basically, that sometimes it's the mistakes that count. You know, you learn from your mistakes. And actually, not only do you learn from your mistakes, which is vitally important, which is the best advice I can give to people starting out, is just make mistakes. Because how else do you learn? Also, sometimes you film something as a mistake, and it ends up being the best bit of footage as well. So there's a bit of that as well.
On the film,
kind of goes hand in hand with each other. But so that was the best bit of advice, is don't be afraid to make mistakes and embrace your mistakes.
Easier to do on digital than film, right?
Yes.
Film, you fall off the cliff if you're not careful.
Yeah,
right?
Sometimes even on, true.
Depends on the job, right? If it's a commercial, you have to be more careful than if it's a music video, for example.
But then saying that, I watched some, I think some things on telly which are shot on film, well, not telly, on like TV commercials or short films.
Yeah.
And they're obviously shot by someone who hasn't got much experience shooting film. And it's because they've pushed the film because they don't quite know what they're doing. They've tried to pull it back. It's giving it a really beautiful filming quality.
Yeah, yeah.
If you get filming, expose it perfectly, then it just looks like digital.
Yeah,
you know, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Yeah. Potentially you can, but not really. So actually sometimes mistakes, fucking about with what you've got, it works.
Have you had any scary experiences of being on set and sort of really sort of feeling in your mind feeling that you technically fucked up? And
not really. I think so.
So
not
probably, on film?
No, I think in film there's always things where I, just that horrible feeling, isn't it? You know, waiting for the rushes to come back and stuff. But since I've been lighting, there's always been digital stills cameras. So as a backup when I'm shooting film, I always used to take stills at the same exposure. Same exposure just to see that you're exposing.
Yeah, yeah, exposing to the right area. Yeah,
it really helps.
Doesn't show you that.
Yeah, really. Exactly. Yeah. And it's a good way to learn the light meter as well, because if you've got time to use that's the other thing, having time to use light meter.
Do you use spot meters at all?
Very rarely, no. Yeah. I just tend to, one of these DFPs that just looks for the eyepiece and lights for the eyepiece.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, that's what I used to do.
And that's why I love it, the iPad thing. Just give me an iPad, I can
just play around until it feels right.
So best thing I'd say, make mistakes. And also, just be passionate about it. You know, we've got to love what we do, and that's the most important thing. And I think having that passion goes a long way, and people notice it.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you stand out.
How do you maintain a passion after having done it for so long?
Very good question. Don't know, quite often I don't. I would say just, you kind of, it depends. Again, it depends on the job. Some jobs it's really hard to be passionate about, because it is just,
What's your favourite sort of moment on a film set? You know, like, is it when you look through the eyepiece and something unexpected happens, or is it like a certain kind of energy you get from the director?
Energy you get from a director, I think. Yeah. You know, when you have that nice energy, I think that's it.
Yeah.
You know,
when you feel really, really valued, right?
Yeah, and you're working well together. That's a really lovely feeling, and you're bouncing off each other.
Yeah.
You know, pushing each other.
Yeah.
That's a lovely feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get directors who are just a bit, almost like timid, or just don't, or either that or really stubborn, which is,
and then get the best out of you.
You reach a wall when you're working, and you're like, it's a bit frustrating.
Yeah.
But so that's good. Having a good relationship with the director is really rewarding.
And next question, what piece of technical equipment could you not live without?
Not a lot. I mean, we talked about lenses. And I think lenses are what make the image more so than the camera.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So I think the lenses are very important. But you can, as we said earlier, you can shoot a thing on, and I've actually shot stuff just on an iPhone. You can shoot stuff on an iPhone, shoot stuff on a GoPro, on a 5D type camera, shoot on anything. So there's no bit of equipment that I think.
Yeah,
you make do with what you've got.
Yeah,
you know, and I.
Do you have a true antenna when with performance? Do you ever speak to the director about performance you might think is a dumb note?
As in the,
if you're seeing something through the camera and you think that there's something not right about the performance, would you mention anything to the director?
Depends on the relationship with the director, but yes, but I wouldn't say it publicly.
Yeah,
Do
you tend to do that a lot? Do directors trust you when?
I try and do it, and just depends. Sometimes you can sense they don't want.
Input. Yeah.
But sometimes it works, and you just it's how you do it. As long as you do it,
What's the best bit of advice you were given in terms of the etiquette on the film set?
Best bit of advice is, well, to be honest, it's just experience from my point of view. You know, when I started out, being in a camera department is like being in the army. You know, camera boxes had to be laid out perfectly, spaced perfectly apart, and you'd queue up for lunch and get the DOP's lunch. I even got DOPs asking me to wash their car. I never did. Yeah. But it was like being in, you know, it was very, and it was good learning though.
Yeah.
You know, and I think.
Boot camp.
Yeah, it was kind of, So I think etiquette is just also letting people do their job. And
realizing you're part of a team.
Yeah, definitely 100%.
That took me a long time.
Yeah, part of the team and letting people do their job and just trying not to tread on toes.
When do you lose your patience?
You've got to help the art department in ways. You got to just always.
When do you lose your patience on set?
What's the thing? Very rarely, to be honest. I try not to be. I mean, impatient sometimes with people who just aren't very good at what they do, and it's like, for fuck's sake. But generally,
do you like art departments?
I don't know if I get frustrated or not.
Hello.
It's fine. Just need to go back to the one question that you skipped over. What's your favourite equipment? You need to answer it as well.
Oh, I need to answer it.
Okay, so what is your favourite equipment?
Well, I can't really live without Kineflow and Dado because I'm so used to their. It's like my eye has been programmed to what they can do, so I kind of know very. But having said that, when I go abroad, I do have to use other light fixtures. But then it's like kind of I use a kind of poor man's light stream by using little reflectors.
Do you then carry your own kit with you sometimes for your jobs abroad?
I actually own some of my own kit for the UK, and we have a different way of working in the UK than we do abroad.
Because they're cheaper now. You've mentioned them.
Sorry?
Do you get them cheaper now you've mentioned them?
I do get, they are going to give me some of their later lights.
You'll have to lend them to me then.
Yeah, I will do, yeah. So you're welcome to borrow anything anytime then. Because they're bringing some really lightweight fixtures out, which I'm really interested in, which are kind of, because like I said, the most important thing for me is the colour science. They've got that bit right. So they kind of, it's like they built it up from the ground up with the correct colours.
Yeah.
Isn't that, because when you go to the shows, you just see all of these wonderful LEDs, but you're like, well, what's the technology of the LED? If it's a shitty LED, it doesn't matter how amazing the light looks. Yeah. You know, it's not going to give you the right colour.
Sky panels can be terrible.
Grey skin, that's why Roger Deakins never uses them. He was always like.
I tend to use a Vortex, you know, the cream sauce make them.
Right, I don't know.
They're like these S60 size. But they're completely waterproof, so you can leave them outside. Oh. And when you take the diffusion off, they're really punchy. I mean, you can use them. I mean, they're big LEDs like this big.
Yeah.
So they do
give a punch.
Punchy. I mean, it's like almost like a 2.5 or 1.8 maybe.
Wow.
But they do.
And what size is the
panel? Because they're lots of things, you do get a strange kind of shadow sometimes.
Yeah.
That's the same.
Sort of slightly multiple
like
shadow.
Like a mini sort of Dino kind of thing.
But,
S60 size, so they're sort of 2.1 whatever it is.
So do you use a combination of HDMI tungsten and LED?
Yeah, I mean, if I can try and go as much LED as I can, I will.
Just for the draw and the speed?
For the draw and the speed, exactly. And these, because they're quite hard, they're handy. And then I sometimes use the kind of, you know, the Hudson Spider thing, the Hudson Mozzie and Spider, the little reflectors you can do things with.
Right, they're I'm not familiar useful. With those either.
And the steerers are very handy. Just
Kineflow are releasing an Astera rivalry.
I saw over there.
There's some single tubes that they're releasing.
Yeah, they
look
quite interesting because they look like they glow all the way around or something.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's 320 or something. They have a little slight mounting point on the back.
Right,
like so, so you get the kind of back glow of them, which is nice. Because they've reintroduced a Kineflow four bank system, but with those LEDs, so you did you use a lot of Kineflows when you started
back in the day? So they're that size, you mean?
They're actually slightly bigger. These are what they call freestyles, but it's the size of a 4 foot four bank.
Four foot four bank,
It's slightly smaller.
Oh, right,
yeah, there's one somewhere around
there's
here.
There's a whole rack of them downstairs, I noticed.
Probably
never get used anymore.
Probably not. Maybe abroad, but it's all LED now, isn't it? Yeah. You know, people want RGB now, don't they?
Yeah.
So it's very important to give, you know, so like you said, that colour control and your colour control. Well, thanks, man.
That's all right. No, it's a pleasure. It's quite fun.
I thought it went really well. I mean, I've learned. It's always nice when I learn stuff, you know, because then I know that the audience are going to learn a load of stuff as well.
Well, I hope it's a help to people listening, watching.
Whatever. Well, and if you can put some of your newer work on the website, because we'll get people to come, because we did mention, there was actually one last thing I could do. So
I'll update my website.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Because the other one we didn't talk about was, I've got sort of just a real quick fire round.
Yeah, go on.
So NHS, we are the NHS. So yeah. My question to you on that was, how many days shoot?
That was quite a few. Scattered, like days scattered here and there, because when we could get into hospitals, I think it was during COVID as well, so we kind of was tricky getting in.
And did you work with real workers and actors, or was it just real workers?
It was all real workers, I think. But all there might have been the odd, because we did a couple. We did that main ad and a couple of other smaller ads where there were acts, but the actors were also nurses, but yeah, also did acting. But I think generally they're real people.
And the OVO Energy, what lenses, do you remember what lenses you used on that? Because they had a really nice sort of creamy narrowed up field, that one.
Yeah, they might have been my
Super Speed.
Then they may have been my contact Zeiss.
Ah, interesting.
I think, because I know we're doing portraits and that, so we wanted to shoot full frame, just because when you're inside, you know, get that less distortion on wide, you know, if you're doing a big wide or something.
Yeah.
So I think there may have been, we also had a Bolex, just to do the odd little shot on Bolex on it as well. Squeezers in there.
Oh, right. Because there's a few jobs where you have found footage as well, like the NHS one.
Yeah.
That was original found footage, was it?
Presumably. The NHS was original found footage.
Yeah.
I mean, some of it, I've got these toy cameras, which are these Japanese little toy cameras called Harenzumis.
Yeah.
And they're now really collectible, I think. But they give a look of Super 8.
Oh, right.
But they're just like these plastic little things.
Yeah.
And they're great. So sometimes I use them and people as to look like Super 8. And it works. You
know. Wait, so that's a digital camera?
Yeah, it's like a crap little digital kind of shoots like the smallest resolution you can see.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a good tip, actually.
Yeah. And also, you know, everyone goes, oh, yeah, we shoot Super 8. Get a Super 8 app for your phone, shoot that. No one knows the difference.
Yeah, yeah. It's really hard to tell these days. I mean, I've really embraced digital now because I think it's better to put your energy into the lighting and, relation with the director and everything.
And that director, Ed Morris, who did that, and we also did a Royal Navy job with him, is, very talented, very forward-thinking. Again, same kind of, we're talking about Frank Budden and Chris Palmer earlier, same kind of background, came from advertising, was a very successful creative, but really thinks outside the box. So he's another one that always pushes to do things differently and just pushing an idea, very much an artist rather than a
bit like
commercial director.
And
Tony Kaye, like that as well.
Yeah. You know, we're trying to get Tony Kaye.
Yeah,
I know. Do you want to hear a quick story? So we sent him this ridiculously grovelly email just telling him how he did change commercials in the 80s, because he really did, right?
Yeah, he did, massively.
And then we referenced the past a little bit too much, so we got this like free word, all in capitals. I didn't change past nothing. I'm present doing this. Speaking of week, you know, this is all in capitals, and so Tony Kaye.
His adverts. I mean, I remember thinking Dunlop advert where they play
the Velvet Underground.
Yeah. And you think, God, if you now tried to pitch a commercial for Tyre saying we want this guy dressed up in a gimp suit standing in the middle of a desert, and everyone goes, fuck off.
Yeah, yeah. And hand painting all of her frames as well. I mean, that was just mental. Like, you know, the twister.
I worked on as an assistant of Eurostar advert when Eurostar first opened. Thomas Krieger was a director, and the same thing, shot all black and white. Freddie Francis lit it, Freddie Young, I get
always. Yeah, I was getting confused as well. And Freddie Young was
same thing. They hand painted all the frames.
I bet that looks amazing. Yeah. Do you like just another director that? Oh, we've got to wrap it up. I was going to mention Ivan Zakaria and Jan Velicki.
Yeah, I don't really know. I know of them, but
I just really love Jan Velicki's work. His website's really worth checking out. It's very, very, very filmic.
Yeah, okay,
and you know, like all those processes when they make pull the grain out by doing into positives and internet bucket up and it's beautiful.
Nice to do that.
I don't know about you, but I've really enjoyed
it's good.
Wait for
I think we could have gone on a lot longer. We'd probably be here all night.
Part two?
Let's do a part two.
Yeah. Because there's a few things that I'm sure Ella will tell me the stuff we should have covered.
Yeah, we'll probably bore all the audience.
No, I think our followers are going to be really into the stuff you've been saying.
Hope it helps.
Yeah. Great. So thank you so much, man.
It's
a real pleasure.
And action!